It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Law with June Grosso from Bloomberg Radio.
For the purpose of this criminal case, former President Trump has become Citizen Trump. That's what the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals wrote as it moved Donald Trump one step closer to standing trial for trying to overturn the 2020 election. In a decisive, unanimous ruling, the three-judge panel found that Trump can't claim that the office of the presidency protects him from criminal prosecution. The judges wrote, "We cannot accept that the office of the presidency places its former occupants above the law for all time thereafter." The judges had made their skepticism of Trump's immunity claims clear during the oral arguments last month. Here's Judge Karen LaCraft Henderson.
I think it's paradoxical to say that his constitutional duty to take care that the laws be faithfully executed allows him to violate criminal laws.
And in the opinion, the judges repeatedly used Trump's words and positions against him. For example, pointing to Trump's position during his impeachment that he could still be criminally charged, something Judge Florence Pan pointed out during the arguments.
You took the position, or your client did, during the impeachment proceedings, that there would be an option for criminal prosecution later, and it's in the congressional record. And I guess the question is, what has changed, or why have you changed your position?
The court put the ruling on hold for Trump to appeal to the Supreme Court, but only until Monday. Joining me is former federal prosecutor Jessica Roth, a professor at Cardozo Law School. The court said our analysis is guided by the Constitution, federal statutes, and history, as well as concerns of public policy. What's your impression broadly of the opinion?
My opinion broadly is that it is a resounding rejection of Trump's claim of immunity from criminal prosecution, and that it's an extremely thorough, well-written, and well-reasoned opinion that is unanimous, issued on behalf of a panel that included one judge appointed by a Republican president, all speaking in one calm but clear voice, holding that a former president is not above the law.
They address all of Trump's arguments for immunity and shoot them down one by one, starting with his argument that separation of powers doctrine immunizes him.
The court took that argument seriously and addressed it thoroughly, but found that there was no problem in separation of powers concerns with a former president being held criminally responsible for actions taken while in office that were in violation of federal criminal laws passed by the United States Congress. And it cited precedents in which presidential actions had been subject to judicial review, including former President Truman's seizure of the steel mills. And the court said it did not find that separation of powers concerns prevented the court from exercising oversight through the adjudication of the criminal laws over acts committed by a former president while in office that, in fact, were violations of criminal law.
As you mentioned, there was a measured tone, but I thought that the tone was a little less measured when they had concerns about, quote, at bottom, former President Trump's stance would collapse our system of separated powers by placing the president beyond the reach of all three branches. At different points, I just thought that they raised some heightened concerns.
They certainly raised concerns, and there were a number of really striking portions of the opinion that, in a sense, in a very measured way, I thought expressed a sense of outrage over the implications of the former president's arguments. So you just read one portion of it. There's another portion where the court said It would be a striking paradox if the president, who alone is vested with the constitutional duty to take care that the laws be faithfully executed, were the sole officer capable of defying those laws with impunity. So there are a number of statements like that that are just really strong rejections of the notion that a former president would be immune from prosecution and from his actions being reviewed by the court.
They also took on policy considerations that he'd raised. Trump's lawyer had said, and Trump himself has said this on the road, that if presidents didn't have immunity, it would risk chilling their actions and that presidents would be routinely indicted after they left office.
Yes, the court did take into account those policy considerations and said that not only was there no historical precedent for immunity from criminal prosecution of the kind that former President Trump sought, but that these policy considerations did not weigh in favor of recognizing such immunity for the first time in this case. They said that it has always been understood that former presidents could be subject to criminal prosecution when they left office. For example, that's why former President Ford pardoned former President Nixon. They cited the example of former President Bill Clinton, who entered into an agreement with the special counsel who had been investigating him with various sanctions, including forfeiting his law license, in part to settle the prospect of a future criminal prosecution. And then most importantly, they cited statements by attorneys for former President Trump during his impeachment trial, his second impeachment trial, where they argued that impeachment was not the proper remedy, but rather the possibility of a criminal prosecution would be the proper remedy. And so they said there are these examples that point toward an understanding that former presidents could be subject to criminal prosecution when they left office for acts taken while president, and that there was no suggestion in the historical record that that prospect had chilled presidents while they were in office from exercising their duties without too much concern. And in fact, there was a quote from the district court opinion that they reiterated in the appellate opinion that I just thought was very telling. The district court had said, every president will face difficult decisions. Whether to intentionally commit a federal crime should not be one of them. And the D.C. Circuit quoted that language saying basically they don't think that they're holding that there is no immunity from criminal prosecution is going to actually chill presidents in the exercise of their duties.
They sort of turned the argument around against Trump. During the oral arguments, Trump's lawyer spent, it seemed like, most of the time on the impeachment clause and this argument that Donald Trump would first have to have been convicted by the Senate in order to then be tried criminally after he left office.
So as the OLC memo points out very clearly, the founders, the framers actually in the Constitutional Convention clearly contemplated that that sequence that I've described would be mandatory. He would have to be impeached and convicted first.
And they took that on and they said the strongest evidence against Trump's claim of immunity is found in the words of the Constitution's impeachment clause.
They did treat thoroughly this argument that he could not be prosecuted criminally because he had not been convicted in the Senate, relying on the impeachment clause. They addressed it thoroughly and said that they rejected it, that they thought it was a strained reading of the clause that he offered, and that although the clause makes clear that a president can be criminally prosecuted after being impeached and convicted, that the negative implication that Trump was arguing from that clause, that he could only be criminally prosecuted if he had been convicted in the Senate following impeachment, simply did not follow.
So in the opinion, you had the legal arguments based on precedent and history and the Constitution. And then there were the sort of logical, sensible arguments. And one here was that, you know, the founders knew how to grant immunity if they wanted to, and they didn't want to here.
Yes, absolutely. They cited to other portions of the Constitution that were explicit about granting immunity, for example, with respect to the speech and debate clause and making clear that there would be immunity there for actions in the course of speech and debate by members of Congress. And so if the framers knew how to be explicit about grants of immunity, it follows that if they didn't explicitly grant it to presidents in this context, that it doesn't exist.
Is there any part of this opinion that you think is weak or subject to attack on appeal?
It is a really thorough opinion, and I think that the fact that the court took its time to write this and to speak in one voice clearly was time well used to write such a thorough opinion. I do not see any weak points in this opinion. I thought it was interesting that the court wrote in a footnote that it was not addressing the situation of a criminal prosecution by a state prosecutor for acts undertaken in office, and nor was it addressing the prospect of immunity of a sitting president from criminal prosecution. So in a sense, it's very much narrowly tailored to the situation before the court.
And where did Trump's arguments about official acts go?
I thought it was really interesting that the D.C. Circuit held categorically that there was no immunity from criminal prosecution for a former president, even for official acts. At the oral argument, and given the briefing, much of which was dedicated to whether these were official acts of the president, I thought it was possible that the court would say, we're not going to deal with the categorical question because we're going to find that there is no immunity here because these were not official acts. In other words, they might have said, arguendo, if we're going to apply the framework for immunity from the civil context to the criminal context, which is what Trump invited them to do, that we would find that even within that framework, these actions by Trump fall outside of his official acts. They could have written an opinion along those lines, but they didn't. And I think that that is significant. It's a really sort of resounding rejection of the idea that there could be immunity from criminal prosecution, even for official acts. The court didn't really discuss whether or not these were official acts in the body of its opinion. They dropped a footnote where they said, even if we were to apply that framework, which asks whether the actions were within the outer perimeter of the president's responsibilities, which is the civil suit immunity framework, they said we are doubtful that most of these acts as alleged in the indictment would constitute official acts. And they cited to their recent opinion in the Blassingham case, which was the civil suit against Trump and others involved in the January 6th riot, where the court did apply the civil immunity framework and found that most of the actions as alleged in those civil complaints fell outside the outer perimeter of official actions. And so although the court didn't squarely address that question in this opinion because it didn't need to, given that it said categorically there is no immunity from criminal prosecution, I thought it was interesting that it did drop that footnote, essentially expressing doubt that these would be deemed to be official acts.
Didn't the judges also throw cold water on any claims that the counting of the ballots, that part of the electoral process, has anything to do with the president?
They did. They talked about how these were not actually acts that were within the president's duty, that these were not matters entrusted to him. And to the extent that he claims that his actions were an effort to see that the laws were faithfully executed, that essentially was a disingenuous argument here because he had no role to play with respect to the administration of the state elections and the counting of the electoral votes, and that in fact what he did was an effort, as alleged, it's an effort to actually undermine the working of the laws that do govern the election of the president. I'd say one other sort of notable quote from the opinion in that regard is the court said, former President Trump's alleged efforts to remain in power despite losing the 2020 election were, if proven, an unprecedented assault on the structure of our government. He allegedly injected himself into a process in which the president has no role, the counting and certifying of the Electoral College votes, thereby undermining constitutionally established procedures and the will of the Congress.
Jessica, you're going to stay with me. Coming up, we're going to discuss whether the Supreme Court will take this case on appeal. I'm June Grosso, and you're listening to Bloomberg.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stiefel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stiefel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stiefel.com. That's Stiefel.com.
Stiefel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
In a unanimous ruling, the D.C. Court of Appeals has found that Donald Trump cannot claim that the office of the presidency protects him from prosecution. Quote, former President Trump has become Citizen Trump with all of the defenses of any other criminal defendant. But any executive immunity that may have protected him while he served as president no longer protects him against this prosecution. This decision moves Trump closer to standing trial for trying to overturn the 2020 election, but it may not be the last word. The court put the ruling against Trump on hold until February 12th for him to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. He might also ask the full D.C. Circuit to rehear the case. Neither court is required to take up his appeal. I've been talking to former federal prosecutor Jessica Roth, a professor at Cardozo Law School. The court gave Trump until Monday only to appeal to the Supreme Court to have this case on hold. Do you think they were looking at his strategy of delay, delay, delay?
I can't speak to what was in the judges' minds in their decision about the timing here. It is notable that they gave him a short time frame in which to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court before they would issue the mandate. I think it speaks to the urgency of the matters involved in this case, and you see that sense of the significance of this case throughout the court's opinion when it talks about how the alleged conduct was an effort to overturn the results of a democratic election and the public's interest in the enforcement of criminal laws. So I think that those substantive aspects of the case may carry over to the court's sense of what is an appropriate time frame in which to allow resort to further appellate review before the case goes forward in the district court.
Does that order, the way it's phrased, mean that if Trump decides to appeal en banc to the D.C. Circuit, that the order won't be stayed?
Yes. So the order makes clear that although Trump could file a petition for rehearing in bank from the full D.C. Circuit, that motion would not stay the mandate. The only thing that will stay the mandate beyond Monday would be Trump filing an application for a stay from the United States Supreme Court. And as I read the D.C. Circuit order, its mandate will be stayed pending the U.S. Supreme Court's resolution of a motion by Trump for a stay. So if the Supreme Court considers an application by Trump for a stay and rejects it, then the case goes back to the trial court, even if the U.S. Supreme Court subsequently grants certiorari.
No one knows whether the Supreme Court will take the case or not, but they already have a couple of Trump cases on the docket, including this Thursday, the case over Colorado barring him from the ballot. What would be your guess as to whether they'll take the case or not?
This is such a well-reasoned and thoughtful opinion that I think there are very compelling reasons why the court wouldn't take this case. There's no circuit split on this issue, and they certainly have their plateful with other really important cases that they need to decide, including the ballot access question. On the other hand, this is an enormously significant issue, whether a former president is entitled to immunity from criminal prosecution. One could imagine the justices saying this is an issue on which we should opine. But on the other hand, unless there are enough justices who think that the D.C. Circuit opinion is wrong, then I could also see them letting the D.C. opinion be the final word on this subject.
So timing is everything here, because the federal election case was on for March 4th, but then the judge had to take it off the calendar. If the Supreme Court decides not to take the case, how fast could the trial be, you know, put back on the calendar and move forward?
Well, the trial court has indicated that she will give the former president additional time to respond to motions that were filed by the special counsel, to file any additional motions on his own behalf, time that, you know, but for the stay of the trial court proceedings, he would have had to work on these motions in this last month or so. So she's going to give him that time. That means we're probably looking at some time at the earliest in late summer, perhaps late July, early August for a trial date. But we really don't know what's going to happen. I mean, if the U.S. Supreme Court were to take the case and grant a stay, that would mean that things would remain frozen. We really don't know. But we do see coming from the trial court in D.C., Judge Chutkan, every effort to move the case along as expeditiously as possible. So I think we may have a better sense by next week, by Monday, when and if Trump files an application in the U.S. Supreme Court for a stay. Whether that's going to happen, I expect it will. And then I would imagine within a week or so after that, perhaps we would have some indication from the U.S. Supreme Court about how quickly they're going to move. And if they're not going to take the case at all, then things may start proceeding even more quickly in the trial court.
So I know that what they say here, and as they said, it has no application to what's happening in Georgia. But Trump did make a similar argument in Georgia, and I'm wondering if the courts there might look to what this court has said.
I think the courts there will look to what this court has said as persuasive authority. Certainly the analysis about the functional considerations about what impact would a holding that a criminal case could go forward have on a president's ability to conduct their official duties without too much concern. I think that would be persuasive to state courts considering whether immunity should apply from a state prosecution. But I do think that some of the language might cut the other way in the sense that one of the things that the court says about why federal criminal prosecutions don't pose as great a concern as the prospect of civil lawsuits is they said, well, essentially there are so many private parties who might file civil lawsuits against a former president, and that prospect is significant enough for us to be concerned about not granting immunity. Those are statements that the U.S. Supreme Court had made in the Fitzgerald case, where it did recognize immunity from civil lawsuits for presidents for actions taken in the course of their official duties. And here the D.C. Circuit said, well, we don't think those considerations apply with the same force with respect to federal criminal prosecutions because prosecutors are subject to a number of constraints before they can bring criminal charges, including a code of ethics, and also having to present their cases to a grand jury composed of ordinary citizens before the case can proceed. So much of that language, I think, works in the same way with respect to state criminal prosecutions. Prosecutors in the states also are subject to codes of ethics before they can bring charges. They also generally have to present them before a grand jury. But on the other hand, there are many more state prosecutors, in a sense, than there are federal prosecutors who are all encompassed within the Department of Justice. So I could see that discussion, parts of it being used to help establish immunity from state prosecution and parts of it being used to establish that there is no immunity from state prosecutions. And then, of course, there's the whole issue of the Supremacy Clause and how that would work in the context of state prosecutions of a former president. That wasn't a consideration in this case because it is a federal prosecution of a former president.
So now we'll be keeping our eye on the calendar until Monday to see what happens with the appeal. Thanks so much, Jessica. That's Professor Jessica Roth of Cardozo Law School. Coming up next on the Bloomberg Law Show, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court has made a ruling in a case over the use of Medicaid dollars to cover the cost of abortions. And the reasoning in that ruling signals a possible new path for reasserting abortion rights. I'm June Grosso, and you're listening to Bloomberg.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
The Pennsylvania Supreme Court has ordered a lower court to reconsider a challenge to the state's decades-old ban on using Medicaid funds for abortions, except in cases of rape or incest. But the state Supreme Court's reasoning has far wider implications. As Loyola Law School professor Jessica Levinson has written in a column for MSNBC, the majority opinion signals a possible new path for reasserting abortion rights, as well as thoroughly rebutting the Supreme Court's Dobbs decision, which overturned Roe v. Wade. And Professor Levinson joins me now. Jessica, in order to put this in context, we have to go back to the Roe v. Wade decision in 1973. Explain how the court used the 14th Amendment there.
Roe v. Wade is the Supreme Court deciding what is included in the word liberty in the 14th Amendment, what is constitutionally protected. And leading up to Roe v. Wade, what the Supreme Court had concluded is that broadly there is this right to privacy that's included in that word liberty, that broadly that includes, for instance, the right to obtain contraception. But the question in Roe v. Wade was, does the word liberty include the right to obtain an abortion? And back in that case, the court answered in the affirmative. They said, yes, it's not written anywhere in the Constitution, but we find these unwritten rights and we conclude that they are included in this word liberty, that the drafters of the 14th Amendment knew that we were going to have to fill in meaning to that word. And one of the things it must mean is the right not just to contraception, but also to an abortion.
And you write that Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the attorney Ruth Bader Ginsburg, would have chosen a different legal theory?
That's right, in part because I think Justice Ginsburg knew that a decision like Dobbs could come down. And I think her feeling was, instead of locating the right to obtain an abortion in the due process clause of the 14th Amendment, instead of saying it's an unwritten right that's included in the word liberty, let's instead look to a different part of the 14th Amendment. Let's look to the Equal Protection Clause, and let's look at how abortions, obviously, and the right to obtain an abortion disproportionately falls along gender lines. It is women and now trans men who can obtain abortions. And what she thought is that it's much cleaner to look at this as an equal protection clause analysis. Obviously, if you limit abortions, that is something that will have an impact on women in a very different way than it will impact men. And I think she was worried about writing rights into the Constitution that weren't written and therefore could potentially be overturned by a future court.
Is that why she was a critic of Roe?
I think that Justice Ginsburg was a critic of Roe in part because she thought that this was cleaner and more legally elegant, not to ever put words in her mouth, as an equal protection clause analysis, saying this is really amounts to gender discrimination when you limit or ban abortions. I think part of it was that Justice Ginsburg was somebody who, when she looked at women's rights, understood that we needed to move incrementally. And I think some of her writing and some of her speeches indicate that she thought maybe we needed to move more slowly when it comes to finding a constitutional right to obtain an abortion. Not because she personally didn't believe in that or didn't believe that it was legally correct, but that she worried about the court and a gap between the court and public opinion.
And now we have the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. Tell us about the decision on the state law banning the use of Medicaid funds for abortions.
So this is a case that's fascinating, where we see now the question largely about abortion rights is going back to states, and in this case, the state Supreme Court. And this is a state Supreme Court that isn't looking directly at that state's Equal Protection Clause, but is instead looking at that state's Equal Rights Amendment. Now, I think that's worth noting, but it's also worth noting that the court, in my view, kind of got very close to talking directly about that state constitution and the Equal Protection Clause. But essentially, I read that state Supreme Court decision as saying, when we look at restrictions on abortion, in this case, you cannot use government funds to obtain an abortion, we have to acknowledge that the impact is falling on gender lines. The court also acknowledged that you are treating certain women, women who want to end a pregnancy, as different from those who want to continue a pregnancy, where the women who want an end of pregnancy get no funding from the government, but those who want to continue and carry a child to term do get funding from the government. So they saw different places where the government is treating arguably similarly situated people differently. And that is what gives rise to this equality question.
And you think it's a much cleaner argument?
Well, I think the argument when it comes to substantive due process on the federal level is obviously done for now. The Supreme Court said in Dobbs, in no uncertain terms, that there is no constitutionally protected right to an abortion under the federal constitution. Now, there are some states that could look at their state due process clauses and decide that abortion is protected. But I think the equality argument does have a lot of appeal, legally speaking. Now, there's still questions that you need to look at. You still need to look at how different states, if and when they have equal rights amendments, the specific wording. You still have to look at the equal protection clause state by state in those states' constitutions and figure out if, in fact, we're going to say a restriction on abortion amounts to gender-based discrimination. So it's not that we're absolutely there. It's that there's a new framework that at least the Pennsylvania Supreme Court is looking at, and then I think offers hope for those who do want legal protections for women in their ability to obtain abortions.
This could work in some of the states. Could it work federally as well?
So I believe it could work federally. If we want to change our paradigm, and again, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court looking at the state Equal Rights Amendment, but if we want to make this conversation broader, and if we want to look at restrictions on abortions as discrimination based on gender, then that is a conversation that we can have under the Equal Rights Amendment. Now, it would take the Supreme Court using a different strategy and espousing a different tact than it otherwise has. This is not a theory that the Supreme Court has ever previously espoused. But I think that you could say, again, because the vast majority of people who seek an abortion are women. There are some trans men, but we're talking about disparate impact here. Then if you're looking at the court's current jurisprudence, what you need to ask is about discriminatory intent. That's a difficult threshold, but I think that this is a legal framework that could be employed on the federal level.
How would that work on the ground? You'd have to have a case where someone challenges an abortion restriction based on the equal protection argument.
Exactly. And then that case has to move up the system. The Supreme Court has to decide to take that case, which I frankly think is not likely. The Supreme Court in Dobbs already said, basically, now we're done. We're not deciding more abortion cases. And of course, that is not true at all. The court is looking at mifepristone, but they're also looking at a case dealing with whether or not there's a federal statute that requires people to be able to obtain free emergency treatment in emergency rooms, whether or not that applies to women seeking abortion. So they're certainly not out of this question.
The Pennsylvania Supreme Court also attacked Justice Alito's reasoning in the Dobbs decision.
Yes. What we saw from the Pennsylvania Supreme Court was a strong rebuke of the U.S. Supreme Court's majority opinion in Dobbs. And what they really reminded us of, and this was specifically in a concurrence as well, is that when you're looking at history, there are often different lenses through which you can look at history. And part of the problem, I think, in grounding constitutional rights based on the time that either the Constitution was ratified or an amendment was ratified, is that that was often a time in society where we had gross inequality. So looking at, for instance, the 14th Amendment and when that was added to the Constitution and asking at that moment whether or not abortions were legal, I think is problematic because it has the effect of kind of entrenching inequality. It has the effect of saying, let's locate this right at a time when women, frankly, were second-class citizens. Women couldn't vote. I believe at the time, spousal rape laws were rare, or at the very least, not the majority. I think the answer is quite rare. But women were not full participants in society. And so there's a problem when you locate rights at a time when our society looked very different.
How do we get to this point where constitutional interpretation means relying on tradition and history, going back to a time when society was so different? I mean, look at the Second Amendment cases where they're comparing modern weapons to weapons, you know, back in the 1800s.
Well, I think people who are originalist or strict constructionalist, what they would say is, I'm a judge, not a lawmaker, and I'm interpreting what provisions of the Constitution mean. And it's not up to me to say what I think is wise or unwise. I don't make policy. I just apply the facts of cases to existing laws, and I help to interpret those laws. And I think proponents of originalism would say it's the only way to make sure that we don't have judicial activism, that we just need to look at the time that the Second Amendment was ratified or the 14th Amendment was ratified and figure out what was allowed and or prohibited at that time. Now, obviously, those who are proponents of originalism, I'm sure, would say much more than I just said. But it is certainly a judicial philosophy that I think has now been espoused by a majority of the Supreme Court. And again, what supporters would say is, I'm not somebody who's elected. I'm the furthest away as a judge from we the people. And so I shouldn't be acting as a super legislator. I should be acting as somebody in Chief Justice Roberts' words, who just calls balls and strikes. And the only way I can do that is just looking at the plain language of these words when they were adopted.
I remember when the late Justice Antonin Scalia and Justice Stephen Breyer used to debate originalism versus the living Constitution. And it appears the living Constitution has lost. Thanks so much, Jessica. That's Professor Jessica Levinson of Loyola Law School. And that's it for this edition of the Bloomberg Law Show. I'm June Grosso, and you're listening to Bloomberg. And that's it for this edition of the Bloomberg Law Podcast. Remember, you can always get the latest legal news by subscribing and listening to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and at Bloomberg.com/podcast/law. I'm June Grosso, and this is Bloomberg.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.